everybody, and welcome to that classic rock show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRULP, the mighty 101.5 FM. I am one of your co-hosts, Jim Samaria.
Greetings, one and all. I am your co-host, Mark Plotnick. Each week, Jim and I bring you music, insights, history, and interviews covering rock music and more from the 1950s through the 1980s, or wherever the music takes us.
Mark and I are authors of the book, Classic Rock, Photographs from Yesterday and Today, and our book features my photography of classic rock artists from 1973 to present day with words from that man across the aisle here, Mr. Mark Plotnick.
Well, speaking of authors, today's guest has spent six decades in the rock and roll trenches, not as a professional musician, but as a prolific author, journalist, and historian, and lest I forget, also a lecturer and consultant.
And he is also one of the most trusted names in music journalism. For a writer to gain the trust of rock and roll types, that's quite a feat, Mark.
Yeah, you know, Jim, I'm embarrassed to refer to myself as a writer after perusing our guest's resume. I think I need to rethink the meaning of writer.
Mark, you're pretty good. You were on Oprah Winfrey's show, if I remember. Yeah. And I don't think he plays blues keyboards better than you. Do you think so?
Well, we'll ask him.
We'll find
out. I think he plays percussion, though.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
But yes, he does.
Let's not waste another moment on my self-esteem. Let's get to our guest and his latest book on Jimi Hendrix, and frankly, and this is the truth. I'm not blowing smoke anywhere here. It's unlike any other Hendrix book I've read. Please welcome author, journalist, historian, and confidant of many, Mr. Harvey Kubernick.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
All right.
We're good. Welcome to the show, Harv.
I'm just so delighted to be here. Chicago has a special place in my heart.
Why is that?
My parents are from Chicago. They moved to Los Angeles in 1947, but I think I still have that Midwest work ethic. And a lot of the people I work with, either they were born in Chicago or their parents were born in Chicago, from my photo librarian to one of the traffic people I work with. And, you know, it's always about food and the Cubs and Dusty Baker and the Michael and the Bulls. I had to watch a lot of Bulls games. And so Chicago is a special place to me. And also I'm just like such a Chess Records music freak that, I'm very familiar with the contributions of the city to the world.
Yeah, it is a great city. And Mark and I are both from here, born and raised. Let's get talking about your book a little bit. So you and your brother, Kenneth, are authors of the fascinating new book titled Jimi Hendrix, Voodoo Child, and it's published by Sterling. You've written so many books, but not all of them include Ken, your brother, as co-author. So I'm wondering if your brother brought a unique set of strengths to this particular Hendrix project.
He sure did. We had done a book together on the band a few years ago, and he's been involved in a few of my books as an editorial consultant or as a voice and a quote source in a handful of books. We did a book in 2012 together on the Monterey International Pop Festival. But he has his life, I have my life, but we intersect a lot. And always in the back of our minds, maybe we can do a Jimi Hendrix book one day. I only own about six of the 300. He has about eight of them. We're not obsessives, but we just kind of thought there was a different kind of Jimi Hendrix book to be done. And my mother said, well, why don't you guys do another book together? I said, well, you know, there has to be a publisher who has to step up to do this thing. I was not going to do an independent route for a book on Jimi Hendrix because he's such a charismatic visual character and his life was so colorful. And I was approached to do this Hendrix book, and I said, my brother and I want to do it. And even in the proposal, we stressed there'll be different slants and angles here, different tunnels. Musicians will be quoted, engineers will be cited. The focus is on music and recordings. And my brother, who is a musician and a keyboardist and a fine writer and author, he knew people that have never really been quoted on Jimi Hendrix at length. I mean, people that are in Vandergraff Generator, people that were in the Soft Machine. He's pals with Brian Auger. And we knew these stories existed. So he brought a lot of that into it, as well as the technical understanding of Jimi as a musician. I'd say there's maybe 90 interviews were done. Maybe I did 80 of them and he did 10, but the 10 he did were just like adding a 22 game winner to your pitching staff. He knew where the players were that could really inform and enhance this book. And I had a basic outline and he was very helpful. We're very close. So I think, you know, what he brought to the table, the two tables joined together.
All right. Well, I want to build upon what you just said. I read an interview where you had remarked, I feel obligated to get the truth out about people I've known in the music industry. So do you feel that there are too many misperceptions that exist about Hendrix and perhaps other acts in the classic rock era?
I do know there's a lot of revisionist history, largely done by bloggers and a term I've birthed called Wikipedia children. I'm not being derogatory, but it's just when somebody's 22, 32, 42, they never saw Jimi Hendrix and the Experience play like I did. They didn't go to the venues in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and 80s. And I think when you have that firsthand experience and knowledge, that's a whole different enchilada. And I think, I just kind of think there's probably been 300 books on Jimmy, and some of them are really strong. But I have over 50 years encountered friends of mine or people coming up to me or musicians who would always volunteer. You know, I saw Jimi Hendrix play in Arizona, or we opened for him in Santa Barbara. And I would make these mental notes going back to at least 1973. I just knew, okay, and I also was cognizant that Jimmy had a strong relationship to the West Coast. One of the box sets is called West Coast, you know, Seattle Boy, but he lived in LA for long periods of time. He played all the venues out here. He had a Corvette Stingray out here. He did live albums that are coming out or gone out before. So he had a strong relationship to the West Coast and Los Angeles and Hollywood that far exceeded, like, you know, Hendrix Live in the West live album. And so I was very cognizant drafting in West Coast, Hollywood, and LA voices, from promoters that have never been quoted in books to booking agents to record company, you know, personnel. And so I think, as you said earlier, there's no other Hendrix book like this. I'm sorry, kids. I'm putting it on the table like the Cincinnati Kid.
For our first Jimi Hendrix song, let's play Lover Confusion off Jimmy's debut album, Are You Experienced?
Is that the stars in the sky? I touched the sun, yeah, so big, so round. Would I be true for you, yeah, in a choosing you as the one for me? Is this love, baby, or is it just confusion? Oh, my head is pounding, pounding, going round. Step
That I like about your book that's so unique are the personal stories and recollections from a wide spectrum of individuals who were associated with Jimmy in one way or another, in particular Kim Simmons of Savoy Brown, because that's my picture in the book of Kim. But
thank you.
Yeah, it's okay. That's what I'm here for. And the story goes, I remember, because I am a friend of his, and I once asked him, I said, did you ever see Jimi Hendrix play? And he said, did I ever see him play? I jammed with him, which is in the book, and that's so cool. Because of your book, the reader gets a more complete sense of who Hendrix was as a man and as a musician due to your great writing and research. But after the book material all sunk in, what was your biggest takeaway or surprise about Jimi Hendrix?
You know, I do want to say I was a hardcore Savoy Brown fan and saw them play at the Whiskey in 1968. And Kim Simmons has always been one of my favorite guitarists. And I did an interview with him on his most recent record, and I got a photo that you took. And I just said, well, I heard that you went to The Experience a lot, T-H-E-E, The Experience, a short-lived club on Sunset Boulevard. And he told me the story about jamming with Jimmy, and I don't really think that's been out there in too many other outlets. And so that was a takeaway, only because I used to walk by that club. I never knew there was so much action going on. But the takeaway for me is going into a market or a bookstore or a club, and some guy or his girlfriend will come up to me and go, are you Harvey Kubernick? I go, yes. She said, listen, my mother is a Jimi Hendrix fan. She bought me your book. And now I understand a lot more about the world my mother came out of. And I said, well, is it like a record collection thing? Do you play the Spectre Christmas album? Do you play the Chess box set? Do you play the Doors? And she said, no, it's the people. Your people and her people are the same. You're music people. You're not products. And I said, wow. So sometimes I'm with somebody and they're a lot more famous than me, like people in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And I go, you were just on stage at the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, and these people are talking to me. You're paying for lunch today. So the takeaways are, I think I gave a, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
I think the takeaways are just so bountiful, because I know that I gave with my brother forum to other writers and authors and voices, their voices. And I'm a big fan of the multi-voice narrative, which has really been reinforced to me by my pal Andrew Lou Goldham, like my favorite writer. And he stressed, bring other people to the party to talk, let them define the environment. And I've been doing that in all my stories, not just talking to principals. So I think other takeaways are, I mean, there's one guy in the book, Daniel Weissman, who I met at age 13, and I think he's 52 now. He just got a book deal for his first novel. I have a sense of pride of finding somebody in some punk fanzine in 1982 and seeing him after age 50 get a book deal, the way I got my first book deal at age 51. We're all lifers, and we have, you know, we're here to serve the music too. And I think my readers, my fans of Jimmy, I mean, I like to do books that after you read them, you're never the same after you've absorbed them. And when I say never the same, it might direct you to a record store to pick up a record of Albert Collins or something. If I'm the guy that makes you find out about Sonny Boy Williamson, that's a real mitzvah to me.
All right, well, let's take a short break and play a song that demonstrates Jimmy's range of expression, both poetically and on guitar. We're going to play the song Driftin' from the posthumously released 1971 album Cry of Love.
Driftin' on a sea of forgotten teardrops, on a lifeboat sailing
like that song Driftin'. That was really good. Again, from Cry of Love from 1971. So let's see what else we can ask Harvey. Let's talk about the apprenticeship of Jimi Hendrix. Can you talk about his early days playing with King Curtis, Isley Brothers, Little Richard, etc.? How important was this period to Jimmy's development, would you say?
Well, extremely important, extremely vital, because he was an ever-evolving musician and guitar player. And I think when you are in an apprentice position or a sideman, and although he did even without the flamboyant clothing per se, people were very responsive to the guitar player on stage, and sometimes he upstaged the headliner. But he understood the road. He understood hotel rooms. He understood travel. He understood bus rides or occasional airplane rides. And all that travel and transport, I think, played a part in the way he eventually wrote his own songs and his own lyrics, because he understood space and dimension. And so by the time we meet Jimi Hendrix in late 66 in England, where he becomes Jimi Hendrix and he's not James Marshall Hendrix anymore, he's had a two, three year period of being all over New York, of playing on the West Coast. And the fact that he saw from a distance people like Elvis Presley, and he did see the Ventures, and he did see some other musicians that played guitar or knew how to work a stage or be the stage, I think it all just fueled his imagination. And that also means he was reading a lot of books and magazines and preoccupied with space travel or exploration. And he ended up transporting us to other, you know, places as well.
Well, it's kind of funny because I read a story where he actually met Leonard Nimoy from Star Trek. They had a pretty wild evening together, and I read this in some interview recently in, I think, Guitar World. So he was really into the sci-fi scene, and it comes across, like you said, many of his songs, like EXP and
Up from the Skies.
Up from the Skies, which is a phenomenal song, and we'll see if we can get that today. Well, Harvey, you know, when I opened your book, I immediately jumped to the Band of Gypsies section. In my mind, the live recording at the Fillmore East left no doubt in my mind that Hendrix was the GOAT. And I actually still believe that today. But I also recall reading interviews that took issue with Jimmy's guitar tuning and Buddy Miles' drumming and the quality of the material. So what were your thoughts when you first heard Band of Gypsies live?
When I first got the original, we'll call it configuration on a single LP,
right,
when it came out, I wasn't some record reviewer. I go, my God, there's more Jimi Hendrix to listen to. I was happy for that.
Okay.
Over the decades, I've seen remixes, remastered editions, box sets, expanded double albums. I've seen this product grow and morph into a complete view. Band of Gypsies, I just did an interview last week with Eric Bobo, the percussionist drummer of Cypress Hill. And, you know, I'm just not a 60s guy. I really do check out the new stuff. I might even go to the Kendrick Lamar concert, okay? And I just said, what album blew your mind? Now, his father was Willie Bobo, such a respected Latin jazz percussionist, beautiful character. And he said, my brother and I first got into it deeply when I checked out the Band of Gypsies, Jimi Hendrix, Buddy Miles. And when he said that, I realized him sing Buddy Miles and Jimmy with Billy Cox, if it made this guy who ends up being on a couple of Beastie Boy albums and is touring the world with Cypress Hill, if it made him get more into rock and roll away from the legacy of his dad's Latin jazz world, that means it worked for him and it works for us. The Band of Gypsies, Dr. James Cushing, a former DJ, dear pal of mine, he makes a really, really potent statement in the book about Band of Gypsies that I don't think anybody really approaches it that way. He thinks it's one of the greatest moments in rock and roll history and compares it to Dylan's 1965 tour with the Hawks that had people that ended up being in the band, simply because it's the end of the decade. It's a record made out of a legal obligation,
right,
from a contract signed years earlier. And Eddie Kramer and I, the engineer, discussed this, where Jimmy took an legal obligation of a record owed to a record label he's never worked with. It's a high stakes moment. And you sit there and you do all new material to an unsuspecting audience. That's a pretty bold statement. And yes, but you see at that about the out of tuning, Jimmy's life at the time was kind of out of tuned as well. So his life reflected maybe the sonic aspect of it too.
Well,
but when I hear things like Machine Gun or Isabella, and it's kind of a power trio, and I mean, I met Mitch Mitchell. I love the Jimi Hendrix Experience. I'm glad he did this, and I think it was going to be a signal of where he might have gone in the future, playing with so many other people,
well,
too.
Yeah, and you know what? On that album, you can also hear Jimmy's R&B influences, because his rhythm guitar playing is as good as his lead guitar playing.
Let me add one thing.
Okay.
This comes from Marshall Chess of Chess Records. We had a Hendrix chat a while ago, or last decade. And he said before the Band of Gypsies performances, Jimmy would play Electric Mud album. And Jimmy and Miles Davis both liked the guitarist Pete Cozley. So you can see the blues thing was on Jimmy's head, that he's playing a Chess Records album between sets, and it's in backstage.
Well, you know, it's interesting. You said in your book that the blues was Jimmy's spiritual guide and that he was the caretaker to an African-American legacy of musical innovation. And I will just tell you this. I heard the blues and Jimmy's playing well before I got taken by the virtuosity. That's what I heard. And that's what you talk about in your book. So let's just, Harvey, let's take a break and listen to the GOAT. Everybody knows what the GOAT is, right?
I have no idea what that means.
Greatest of all time?
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Are you talking about me or Jimi Hendrix?
No, we're not talking about Tom Brady now.
Oh.
So, okay, let's listen to the GOAT on his 1970 album that features Buddy Miles on drums and R&B buddy Billy Cox on bass. Here is Message to Love.
Please stay tuned for part two of that classic rock show on Huntley Community Radio, WHRU LP 101.5 FM, where we'll continue our discussion with Harvey Kubernick.